Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI COVID Response Pivotal Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts, along with Ann Kinzel, who is co-hosting via Zoom.
Greetings. Thank you for listening. Here's your COVID-19 data as of this morning. Story County had its first reported death from the virus this week. The tally of positive cases is currently at 27, according to the state's website, but word is that when they are able to update it, the tally will actually be 30. Polk County is at 905 tested positive cases with 32 deaths. Dallas County reported 258 tested positive, Hardin and Hamilton 7. Marshall County has 459 cases with one death. Black Hawk County now leads the state with its number of cases jumped by 1,000 last week. According to the state website, there are 1,082 cases with 13 deaths in Black Hawk County. Most of the cases are from an outbreak at Tyson's Waterloo plant. There are still more tests waiting for results. The county's public health director, Nafisa Cisse-Igbanye, said at a press conference on Monday, COVID has had a huge impact on this community. 1,346 cases, that's 1% of the population in Black Hawk County. In Iowa, currently, there are 643 reported cases with 148 deaths. And our heart goes out to all those affected.
Here in Story County, we are still fortunate to see a relatively flat curve, as they say. We're seeing the numbers increasing at a steady but slow rate. We have invited the chair of Story County Board of Supervisors, Linda Merkin, back to Local Talk to talk with us. Linda, thanks for coming back to check in. And you were here at one of what were really the very first days of the crisis here in Story County. And you were just in the process of adjusting county government functions and ways of operating in order to continue services as well as possible. Where are we at now in Story County?
Well, thank you for having me back. Yes, lots has changed since the last time that I was visiting with you. We made several decisions, basically to close our buildings to the public and to have as many of our employees as possible teleworking, doing work from home, either through electronic means or taking actual paperwork home and doing. We've got employees who are answering phones from home. They've transferred or forwarded their office phone to a cell phone and are helping people that way. So I know what the public looks at is our buildings are not open to the public. That means we're not working. That's not the case at all. Vast majority of our employees are working right now, either like in the jail where they have to be to work and at some other offices or working from home.
So in order to access services, we're talking about internet and telephone, right?
We're talking primarily internet and telephone. And if people go to our website, storycountyiowa.gov, on the homepage are the telephone numbers of all of our offices. So they can call, they can also access email there. If you're doing business with the treasurer's office, a lot of that can be done online. There's a link that takes you to the Iowa Treasurer's Association website where you can pay, motor vehicle registrations, property taxes, those things. Occasionally, somebody needs to get into one of our buildings because it's a physical record they have to look at. And we do that sparingly, but we have had people come in one at a time for an appointment when they just have to do it that way because we don't want to slow down business. I know everybody's concerned right now about the impacts of the pandemic on business, and we don't want to put any roadblocks there to slow down any business that needs to be done.
What operations have shut down, or what can't one do now?
Well, one of the things is, like I said, you can't get into the building to just pay something normally. Our animal shelter is closed right now. We're taking care of all of the animals. We're going out. Our animal control department is going out if there's any problems in the communities that contract with us. You know, if there's an animal needs to be taken care of, they will do that. But we're not allowing visitors into the animal shelter right now.
So you can't adopt a pet right now?
No, and we did try, but it became too difficult to do and to control the number of people who were coming in and the time that they were spending. And all that means is that you got people from, you know, members of the public then, you know, coming in, and you don't know what the situations are. So no, we did suspend adoptions for the time. We're taking requests. We're just not completing them right now.
Mm-hmm. So, Linda, when you became a Story County supervisor, what, kind of a year ago or 2 years ago?
It was a year ago this January that I was sworn in.
Right. So when you became a supervisor, did you ever dream that you would be dealing with a pandemic?
No idea whatsoever. But one of the things that I did look at pretty quickly is we have a continuity of operations plan for maintaining continuity of government. We call it the COOPCOG. That's the initials of it. We had a training session on that early, and I was really glad because in my previous job, I had some experience with some emergency planning. Most of it was the Y2K planning, which, of course, we all remember never came to fruition. But, you know, that was an awfully good planning exercise. So when I saw that we had a continuity of operations plan, I thought, I want to dig into this, and I want to see what this is about. And it's a very thorough plan. But the reality is when you're planning for an emergency, you don't know what you're planning for. We think in Iowa, we're planning for tornadoes, we're planning for blizzards. The word pandemic did appear once in the plan, but what we found out is that what you're doing in a pandemic is a lot different than what you're doing in a tornado. Because, and this is the thing about this pandemic, and I think it's something we can talk about here, is that a pandemic in this age where you have international communication, telecommunications, news, you know what's going on in Wuhan, China, months before it hits the United States. You know, it's a slow-moving emergency, so to speak, because you know all of that. So you have the opportunity to prepare and think about what are you going to do if or when it hits here. And I think that's one advantage we've had. I'm not sure we've always used that advantage to the best, you know, in this nation to the best, but that's maybe a conversation for some other time. But one thing I really want to do when we're done with this is you do an after action review. You say, okay, what worked and what didn't work? What have we learned from this? Because unless you really have to, you don't change your emergency plan when you're in the middle of, you've activated it. You go with it and you maybe tinker around the edges, but you don't make major changes when you're in the midst of something.
Linda, so far, what's worked for Story County?
I think that the slowing down of things, I think the social distancing has worked really well. I have been pleasantly surprised I've been pleased that our employees, and I'm just talking for the county right now, are really innovative and really creative in terms of how we can get the job done without having our doors open to the public, how we can reach out. I think that has worked. I think Iowa State, as you said, we have some very low numbers here, 27, maybe we're at 30 now. That isn't shown on the IDPH website. But when you look at the other counties, I have to go back and say, Iowa State closing when they did early, sending students home, I think really helped Story County incredibly.
Yeah. What about what didn't work?
What didn't work?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Or worked less well than you thought in your plan?
I think it took us a little while to figure out what social distancing really meant. And that's something when I've been looking at a lot of evaluation materials right now. I've been looking at a lot of models, and I'm not a researcher, but I can read it. And I've been trying to figure out, you know, what are we doing in terms of our response? And I remember something from my previous job that when you're looking at evaluating programs, you look at process and outcome evaluations. We all want to know the outcomes. We want to know what happened or, you know, what our results were. But if you don't do something called a process evaluation first, you don't really know what you're looking at. And the process evaluation means you're looking at the policies that you're presuming have come into effect, and you test to see, are we really following those policies? Are we really following the protocol we said we were going to get certain outcomes? And I think that's where we may be with the social distancing. And I picked that up in one of the University of Iowa papers that recently came out, is they're saying in one of their models, they're saying, okay, it was at March 13th, the governor said, we're going to do social distancing. He said, but do we really know how effective social or how effective that policy or how much that policy has been followed is the way I should say it. So their models, they even back that off a week on one model in terms of predicting the number of deaths that we will have. They said, let's say that by March 17th, that social distancing wasn't 100% in effect. Let's back that off a week or 2 weeks, sort of April, and see then what, you know, what the contacts, what the transmission rate would have been if the social distancing really didn't just take hold on March 17th.
Wasn't social distancing kind of hard to evaluate, because there's two components there. You're talking about a policy at one level, and then you're talking about the behavior of humans at another.
Exactly.
Well,
and
Linda,
a lot of this is difficult to evaluate.
I mean, a lot of this, I think, we'll understand more in hindsight. At this exact moment, Linda, what really weighs on your mind? I'd like to know what really worries you, what you feel really has to be looked at right now that is critical.
I'm concerned when I see the numbers and that Ann read just a little while ago of the counties to the east, directly to the east of us and directly to the south of us. I'm also concerned about how quickly the numbers grew in Black Hawk County. And when we have some counties that have social distancing still, when we are still under the guidelines that the governor announced, and some that where restrictions are easing and they're right next to each other, that concerns me. We know we have people who work in Marshall County and Polk County and probably Dallas County who live in Story County and live in Boone County, which is basically right abutting Ames. You know, we know this, but now we also have different degrees of our communities being more open, our businesses being more open. And I hope that doesn't encourage people to come to Story County, to restaurants, and I hope it doesn't encourage more travel right now.
So I think
have you been able to articulate that to the governor as a supervisor?
I would say we have another board meeting tomorrow, and we are going to be hearing at it from Les White, who is the Story County Public Health Director. I asked Les at the request of the other supervisors to come and talk with us. What we wanted to hear some of the things from IDPH she said she would check on. She knew somebody she would check on. I'm very interested in contact tracing. What I've heard doesn't seem to be that we're doing very robust contact tracing. A lot of the models I've seen and a lot of the recommendations for reopening talk about increased contact tracing. So we know who is positive or who's been exposed, and we're getting people isolated. You know, to lower that rate, the transmission rate is supposed to go down to one person transmitting to one or fewer people in order to say we're really, you know, flattening that curve and getting a downward trend. I don't see in any of the numbers I've seen at IDPH that we're anywhere near, you know, flattening that curve. I think people use different definitions of that.
So Linda, you're
face shields and some other issues.
So you're saying in so many words that you're not convinced that it's time yet to relax restrictions on businesses?
Well, the University of Iowa researchers are saying that loud and clear. And I've read both of the reports that they sent to the governor that the Register finally got hold of and published, looked at other things. And particularly Dr. I think it's Perencevich's comments that were quoted in the Register. And then I saw on Twitter before that was just saying, I think that the governor and IDPH are reading their own epidemiological curve incorrectly. I think we're moving too fast. And that's kind of what, you know, we have decided at Story County government, what we're responsible for, a go slow approach.
Okay. So you're encouraging people to go slow regardless of what opens and what doesn't, is to keep going slow.
I am. I think we've got so much time invested, individuals' time, business time, government time, wherever. We've got so much time invested in social distancing and trying to control this through the means that are within our control right now, because we don't have a vaccine. We don't have the testing available we should have. Social distancing is probably the best tool we have. And when they say, if we open up, we're concerned that we'll be shutting down again because the numbers could go up quickly. When we have so little good data, I think a very cautious approach is important. And we really have difficulty in comparing data. I've been seeing some things come in daily about what various approaches states are taking. And when you start reading it state by state, you realize that there's not just one or two approaches. There's really almost 50 approaches out there. They vary so much. How do we compare states to state? We don't know, as I said earlier, to what extent policies are being followed or guidelines are being followed. We don't know the number of people who aren't symptomatic but have it and are shedding virus. That's such an inelegant phrase, but I think it really gets people's attention. You know, we're shedding virus as we talk, as we sneeze, cough, whatever, even if we don't have symptoms. You know, and there are also, I've seen recently about the number of deaths, and this is in maybe states with larger numbers, but haven't been attributed to COVID-19. People who died at home early on in particular. And they're saying, you know, looking back, that's probably a COVID death. But a lot of times the death certificates, the causes of death, that lags so much. We don't really know. And when we don't really, I really believe in database decision making and looking at the data. And that's what we're going to try to do. Even though that data we have is imperfect, we're going to do our best with it. And I did want to mention one other thing. Somebody might say, where did the Troy County supervisors get their metric that we're going to look at a 14-day downturn in positive cases? That comes straight out of the Opening Up America guidance that our president put out. I think what's unfortunate there is people haven't looked at that document very much. They sometimes listen to the words, and the words didn't really always reflect what was in the document. But we looked at that. And it's called great gating criteria. You need to have 14 days of a downward trend in the positive reported cases, and your hospitals, your medical centers have to not be overloaded. They have to not be in crisis mode to even considering phase one. And then you go to phase one, where you've got limited reopening. You look at another 14 days, and if you still meet the gating criteria, and if you continue to have a stable or downward trend, you can go to phase two, then you go to phase three. It doesn't say what data to look at in terms of data sources, and that's the problem. But it gives to me a good rationale for how you do this. I think they use the UAME, Institute of Metrics and Health Metrics Evaluation, the University of Washington people. I think they use some of their information. I think they use some other good models that were out there, whoever put that together. And really, it's for a layperson to look at and say, this, I'm saying, it's not bad. It helps me think of what I should focus on in making the decisions that I can make locally, which are just about county government.
Okay, thank you, Linda. We have about 2 minutes left. I want you to speak real briefly about voting. We got our absentee ballot yesterday in the mail. And just a word about that. What is happening? Why is it coming? What do we do now?
Well, you know, everybody who wants to can vote absentee, and the request came in the mail the absentee ballot request form the Secretary of State sent out. That's postage paid. If you want to request an absentee ballot, fill that in, drop that in the mail, and our county auditor will get you one. It is the safest way for everybody, for you all to vote right now. If you have a question, call the auditor's office, 382-7210, or go to our website and do an email. We, by law, have to have in-person voting, both during the early voting period, which is May 4th to June 1st, and, of course, have the polls open on Election Day, which is June 2nd. The polls, we will have combined precincts. We won't have all 43 precincts having a polling place. I think it's going to be around 19. That will be publicized. We will also have early voting in Nevada in person, but I would really encourage people to vote by mail because that means we are opening our administration building for voting. That's the only thing it will be open for. But please call the auditor's office or get in touch if you have questions. And thank you for bringing up the absentees.
Tell us again the auditor's phone number.
382-7210.
Okay. Thank you, Linda Merkin. Linda is chair of the Story County's Board of Supervisors. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ursula and Ann. We appreciate the time.
Okay. You take care.
You too.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI COVID Response Pivotal Radio. The Iowa primary elections will be coming on June 2nd. We were just talking about the election coming up, and numerous candidates are campaigning to be the Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate to challenge U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. KHOI's Cal Halliburton has been speaking with the candidates who are vying for the Democratic candidacy. And a lot of these recordings were made prior to the COVID crisis, so he was able to come into the studio and speak with them. So let's listen to his recorded interview with candidate Mike Franken. And again, just to remind you, Mike Franken does not bring up the current crisis because it had not happened yet when he was speaking with Cal. Here's Mike and Cal.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Admiral Mike Franken. Mike is seeking the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for the United States Senate from Iowa. Mike, tell our listeners something about yourself they'll not find on your website or with a search engine.
Well, let's see. I spent a couple of years working in a hog slaughterhouse. It was a great way to pay for a college education, and it also laid the groundwork to purchase my first house. I've been a bartender, a bar manager, worked as a math tutor, farmhand, truck driver, construction worker, grew up in a machine shop as a welder and doing all those things in my dad's machine shop. So I'm comfortable in lots of lines of different work, including as an engineer for a law firm. So from white collar to gray collar to blue collar. I don't think that's on my website anywhere.
As you talk with people around the state, what are their most frequent concerns?
Well, it depends what slice of society with whom you're having this discussion, but there are some parallels regardless. Healthcare is I think, preeminent, followed by climate change. And also there's a divisiveness, a division in society, which I think everyone's looking for an ability to bring that back together so that we believe that there are some shared end states, but perhaps the methodologies to achieve that are not as clear and not shared across various socioeconomic lines.
What do you think we can do to address that division?
Well, I think got together with some firefighters not so long ago, and this is an attractive group of men and women fit at that prime of their working age, et cetera. And we went through a spectrum of things such as well-being of their health programs, retirement, children's education, human rights, international affairs, national security, responsible gun ownership, the whole slather of things. And to two sigma, to a high percentage, everyone shared the same end state and very, very little bit of dissension amongst the party. And then ultimately I said, okay, so raise your hand if you identify as a Republican, Democrat, or as an independent thinker in this group. And it was generally one-third. And they said, you know, we've never done this in the workspace before and really uncomfortable doing this. But I said, okay, so now there's divisiveness amongst the parties. But really when we talk about the issues, there really wasn't any. Don't we all agree? And I mean, we got some laughs about that because in the end, I think the men and the women in that group perhaps had more divisiveness with their spouse or their best friends than we did across the party politics. So, I mean, there's things need to be healed, certainly in this country. We should look at some of the special interest, which I think in many respects has cleaved aspects of society and have unnecessarily taken away some of the rungs of the ladder of success that we've all, that's been good for me, rising from Northwest Iowa. And I think if the socioeconomic opportunities were applied evenly across the board for everybody, we would see less divisiveness.
What kinds of opportunities do you think folks are looking for then?
Well, that's a great question. To each their best capabilities. I had a discussion on the way here about national service, which I think if you, when you gather a group of people together, they'll say, you know, that would be nice to have an option for an 18 to 22-year-old to 24-year-old. That is a way to bring people together, and that develops a different option set for an 18-year-old to either stay with the parents' work or to go to college or go to trade school, get a job in small manufacturing or some initial job offering at minimum wage. I think it's good, would be good if we instituted that and not necessarily make it mandatory, but expand that. That's one option. But education needs to be affordable. This is an education town, of course, and it's near and dear to me, having spent a lot of time in school, in life, and all of it's been highly beneficial for me. So school, making it an option for everyone. Making payment to some form of payment tolerable for something that they can not have to pay for the next decade and a half of their lives. And also, we should look at other means of using what this country can do the most of, and that's initiative, inventiveness, and application of our plentiful natural resources to A, save those natural resources, and B, reapply them to a better quality of life across the state.
With your service, long-time service, you're accustomed to knowing how big systems work. And it seems that some of our big systems today are not working as well as they once did. What do you see as solutions for dealing with that?
So big systems, I would expect, like Social Security.
Social Security, healthcare, as you mentioned. Practically anything that government does involves a fairly large system. How do we get these systems maintain constant viability to improve and get better over time?
Well, each one, I think, needs to be addressed singularly, and then all of them need to be address in a comprehensive manner because so many of them are interdependent. Let's speak infrastructure. When I was chief of legislative affairs, I mentioned to the Secretary of Defense that when we were lamenting how broken the politics were at the moment, I said, well, if we can't get an infrastructure bill passed, which generally slathers across all of society opportunities to enhance the community, urban and rural alike, we've really got problems. Well, here we are many years later, and we're still looking for that solution. Certainly, candidates for office should speak with less slogans and more practical application. How to do things. I mean, wonkishness in answers is a good thing. How are you going to implement things? None of this flag-waving, hand-waving, nonsensical, for this, against this, et cetera. It has to be able to – we have to pay for it. And there has to be a tax and a revenue-generating capability to pay for these great opportunities. We've got good people in government. Don't let anybody tell you differently. We need to, as a nation, elect people. And when I'm speaking of people in government, I'm talking about workers, civil servants, civilian employees to the government. Electing people who can work system of systems and do the integration of these big systems for each one, Social Security. We should take the $180,000 cap off Social Security, which, let's face it, people with $300,000 income are paying at a far lower percentage with the Social Security reduction at the $180,000 than somebody that with substantially less income. I don't think that's fair. So a more fair society, And we can address some of these large systems that seem to not be healthy in the future. The military. We have a military system, and I'm, of course, been a party of that. I signed up in 1978 and got out in 2017. I've been involved in many strategies and authorization of various equipment systems and spent a lot of my time deployed and also working in Washington, D.C. and multiple tours on Capitol Hill. There is excess in the military budget. We are not necessarily choosing the bright applications of our military. And we should be more diplomatic, and we should use our levers of commerce more effectively and consequently save these trillions of dollars that we've unfortunately misspent in the Middle East to build ourselves. And not only ourselves. I mean, this isn't only about America, but make America the leader in things like climate change, addressing climate change, make America R&D be the world leader, not be usurped by neglect, and consequently the Chinese take the role. There's things we can do, and we need to work harder at that. And these major systems that you speak of can be one at a time addressed and then brought together in a comprehensive manner. That was a hard last question, I got to tell you. I have never had that question before. And I mean, I tell you, it invigorates me to think about each one and knocking them off. I wish we had the leadership necessary to do that. And, you know, in the end, it's this old thing about rallying the troops, to get stuff done and have the verve and the vision and the initiative and the wherewithal to make it happen. You know, I look back at when the chips are down, and I got to tell you, in a divided society such as we are, there's some goodness that's going to come out of this. We just can't let it go fall off top dead center. But, and I think about Roosevelt driving around rural Georgia in 1932 that had, 5% of rural Georgia had electricity. When he died in 45, 95% of rural Georgia had electricity. Have the vision, execute it.
We have the same type of opportunity with high-speed internet.
High-speed rail. I drive east-west across the state with resounding frequency. I wish I could get into a fast car in Council Bluffs and buzz on over to Davenport and wave to Des Moines as I pass through and not have this issue. And I don't know why we can't go from Des Moines to Minneapolis on a 200-mile, 200-kilometer train and make it the way we travel. You know, as I saw pictures of Sioux City, Iowa, with their elevated or the electrified trains of years ago past, that was an efficient way to get around town. Now, things have changed. I got it. But going from Iowa City to Des Moines hasn't changed. Let's change that. Iowa, what a great place to do that. Let's string high-speed rail. Let's use these rail lines for high-voltage transfer lines. And let's use DC voltage for high voltage and make efficiencies here and there. I mean, there's 1,000 things we can do. Let's address ethanol. Let's address all the heat equation associated with ethanol and make Iowa the Salinas Valley of farm-to-table growth. Use the water, use the carbon-rich environment, and use the heat for grow houses connected to all ethanol plants in the state. This is what the Chileans would do, what the Israelis would do, what the Germans would do. We just need to, with government necessary assistance, and matter of fact, we're going to have to do this with government, we can change the face of agriculture. And Iowa City does the policy, and Iowa State does the science behind it. I mean, we've got a 1-2 punch sitting right here to be the nucleus of a new face of ag.
Oh, there are a whole list of issues. You mentioned bringing the systems together, and you talked about
that's a hard question.
How we do
the, me on that one.
Do the rest of the stuff. Are you familiar with Michael Lewis, the author? His one of his latest books is called The Fifth Risk. And, of course, the first four risks are kind of obvious. They deal with keeping track of our nuclear weapons and the kinds of things that the Department of Energy does with nuclear materials and so forth. But then it gets down to the fifth risk, and it just seems so commonplace and mundane. And so he searched for a term he could use for that, and he just came up with project management, meaning that it's extremely important that we have competent, knowledgeable people in government to operate so many programs that we and so many projects that we have ongoing. So we've got a whole mess of these things that require competent management. And I'm thinking some of the best people that I've ever met have been spoken of derisively as bureaucrats or today as the deep state or some other euphemism.
Fundamentally makes me hugely upset. Now, and here's my story on that point.
Please.
So I was a mentor and a proctor of two different classes. One, going in to speak to the outgoing ambassadors, the ambassadors that are going into the field. So these are both professional diplomats and also political appointees, about 50-50. And my discussion with them was talking about the fusion between development, diplomacy, and defense, and then how they would work with the DOD people that are in their stations. And how it works between the agency people and the other agencies and the international, you know, the UNHCR, et cetera, and the U.S. military, and how that comes together, et cetera. So I get a cross-section of professional people and then also those that came from Ma and Pa, whatever, and got appointed by the administration. My other job was mentoring this cross-section of mid-level, upwardly mobile professionals from every branch of government, from Sandia National Labs to State Department to Commerce to Treasury to Ag, etc. And a good group, about 40 people. And this was just when the deep state was talked about freely. Nobody knows what they're talking about. And denigrating the government and talking about government waste this and how they're all sided with the other party and how they've messed with their election. That couldn't possibly be further from the truth. These are the most upstanding group of people. And I mean, I tell you, it was upsetting, reprehensible to be speaking in such terms of the people that I sat around in those classrooms. They were the finest among us. And the mothers and parents and spouses and partners and 60, 80-hour work weeks and smart and master's and Ph.D., hardworking, who on a corporate environment would be monsters of the corporation. But they've chosen to stay in government. And they are, A, brave, patriotic. It is what keeps the wheels of government aligned. And the nonsense that we vote into office is the one that tries to knock this wheels of government off the train.
Mike, thank you so much for coming in today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Hope I didn't get you in
trouble.
And a
pleasure hearing what you have on your mind. We hope to have you back again.
Yeah, well, I look forward to it. We didn't talk about international affairs or migration or immigration or anything like that. We'll save that for next time.
Okay, that's fine. I sense you do have another appointment coming up.
Yeah. Well, thank you, dear sir.
This is Local Talk on KHOI COVID Response Coronavirus Pivotal Community Radio, big name little radio station. Thanks for listening. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts.
And I'm your other host, Ann Kinzel, joining you via Zoom. Susan Guiazda, Ames Public Relations Officer, and Justin Clausen, Operations Manager for Ames Public Works, are also here. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
So,
Susan, Susan, do you have any announcements for us today? It seems like each time we meet, you have something new to tell us.
Well, as you know, the business of the city continues, so I wanted to basically let people be aware that a longtime project in our Public Works Department, which is the reconstruction of Welch Avenue, will actually begin next week. It'll start on Lincoln Way, so the two blocks between Stanton and Hayward will be down to two lanes or one lane of traffic in each direction. So if that stretch of Lincoln Way is somewhere, is part of your commute each day, you might want to consider a detour or just be aware that there can be delays. That one-way traffic in each direction will continue for about a month through that stretch. And that indicates the beginning of that project, which includes replacing infrastructure on that first block on Lincoln Way that's over 100 years old. So that project, reconstructing Lincoln Way and replacing the infrastructure, will take place in the summer through all the way till sometime in November, most likely. And we'll end up with a beautiful new street and streetscape, but it will cause some inconvenience as construction happens. Justin has a lot of big projects this summer, and I was hoping that he could share some of those with us.
Yeah, Susan, that's a great way to kick off the conversation about Welch Avenue, and in particular the traffic narrowing of lanes there on Lincoln Way. As you said, some of the water main in that area is from 1906. So it's actually 114, wow. Going on 115 years old.
Wow.
So it's obviously original to the area. So, you know, as part of the ability to, increase not only the multimodal use of that street, but also the infrastructure underneath it while we're doing it, they need to get into Lincoln Way to tie in some of the water and sanitary sewer. And so that'll take a little time. But, you know, that's the Welch Avenue project is obviously one that's been on our radar for a while, and being able to kick it off now. You know, I hate to say ever taking advantage of COVID, because it's obviously a terrible thing, but the traffic volumes in that area are down. The student population is down in that area right now. So we're trying to jump in on things as best we can and try to make that happen while we have less impacts is what we're hoping for.
So, Justin, are you increasing the number of projects during this time when the streets are quieter?
I would say probably not increasing. So we're kind of set to the number of projects we do that we present to council every year in our capital improvements plan, our CIP, we call it. So that hasn't really changed. But what we're doing is we're looking at ways we can take advantage either on a project basis like this in areas where we might have low traffic, or some of my maintenance activities that some of my staff does, street patching, water main maintenance or whatnot. We're looking at targeting those areas as well. I'll take, for example, we did a water valve maintenance. We had to dig down and replace some bolts on a water valve right at Dotson and Mortensen last week. We took advantage of that because the middle school is right there at Dotson and Mortensen. Obviously, they're not in session. Where we have to do it is right in the middle of the intersection. So it kind of snarls up traffic for about 4 or 5 hours. And trying to do that during a normal school day is obviously not possible. So we have to wait till the summer. And what happens in Ames a lot is we try to cram a lot of things into the summer. You know, those times when our traffic volumes are down or our populations, you know, maybe not cut in half, but the student population is down. So we have a little bit more flexibility. So right now we're not maybe adding projects, but we're being really targeted on where we're doing stuff, trying to take advantage of the situation and where it's at right now.
So just
so your employees, how is this affecting them?
Oh, this is, we're not immune to it, just like anybody else. We have, trying to take steps. So we've done things such as, changing start times for some of our crews. I've got a staff of about 40 that come here to I call it our maintenance facility. And so we kind of start the day here, then we go out to do work out in the field. So what we try to do is limit where we start, when we start. We've spread our I call it our break rooms, but the tables out into our shop. So we've maintained social distancing, 6 feet. You know, we've basically spent a lot of time on education and what to look for, what to watch out for, how to manage crews, because they have the same issues that everyone else has. They might have a spouse or childcare or something that something comes up, they can't be at work. So we're trying to be flexible within the policies that the city council has given us to help, you know, help our employees. So we experience the same thing, but at the same time, on the flip side of that, our work still goes on. Potholes still form, water main breaks still happen. That sort of stuff is still going to happen. So we need to be there. We need to be present. We need to make sure that the essential services that we provide the community continue. So we've got, staff out doing that. We might be a little bit slower at some things because we're trying to maintain some of that social distance for our crews in the field. And where they can't, we've obviously, they've got, you know, the cloth masks that we ask people to wear to the grocery store. You know, our crews have those to utilize as well to try to keep everyone safe. At the same time, keep the streets in good shape and the utilities working and all that sort of stuff.
So, you know, during this time, there's a lot of yearning for feeling of normalcy and life goes on. And I think, Justin, a lot of the work you do is kind of that. You are proof that life does go on and the city keeps working on its projects, right?
Yes. It's a conversation I've had with my staff numerous times that there are times where it's just important for us to be seen, maybe more than it is to ensure that production's at 100%. Sometimes there might be someone you don't even realize sees your vehicle on the street and you're picking up that piece of trash or you're filling that pothole. And it's going to give that person, like you said it well, or so that sense of normalcy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are craving that. And we can do that in our daily activities without doing anything but just being who we are.
Right.
And that's probably really important when people are in their houses and can't get out, making sure, you know, I look at our street sweeper, for example. Our street sweeper goes all over town. And we're continuing to do that. You know, when people see that, they can see, oh yeah, things are going like, you know, the life will move forward at some way, shape or time. We're still out doing those things.
Yeah. And, you know, I've had a thought too, when I see the city workers and, you know, I'm affected by what's happening right now on 6th Street because I work near 6th Street and, the street is closed and for a block or two. And, I had this thought, you know, because as I walk around the residential areas, I see people who are practicing isolation. They're working on their yard. They're working on their house. And they're kind of catching up on things. And then I see the city working at it, and I think, you know, well, the city's doing the same thing too. They're, you know, they're fixing up the city while we're not using it as much, or the streets. And you're saying you're doing a little bit of that, not really as much as it seems, but it just feels like everybody's fixing things up right now.
I think that's right. I think it's, you know, it's a good thought of how do you, you know, in uncertain times, you know, because what has happened to, I'll take the Public Works Department, for example, we're funded through road use tax. So that means people need to buy fuel for their cars to do that. Well, the Iowa Department of Transportation will tell you that there's a 40% drop in car in vehicle trips through the middle of April, the last I had heard. So that affects road use tax, which means the funding that comes into our department obviously goes down. And that's the case everywhere, not only in our department, but, you know, if you're using water, you know, with Iowa State not having as many students here in town, the water revenues go down. So we're being cognizant of where we're spending money, make sure we're not, you know, overextending ourselves and looking at it from a fiscal standpoint as well. But at the same time, trying to invest in ourselves, trying to make sure that we're doing those patching. 6th Street's a good example there. You know, we've got the, you know, maybe a short week in that area where it's during a normal spring, it would be busy because there's a lot of businesses going on, a lot of things going out there. We try to jump on it, take advantage. Say, we got a little bit of work to do here. It's going to be a inconvenience for a few days, and then we can get out of the way and hopefully not have to be back there for several years.
Yeah. Well, Justin, thank you so much for joining us. Is there any other project that you'd like to mention before we move on?
Probably the big thing that people should be aware about, and yay, it's happening. The Grand Avenue Extension Project continues to move forward. So that's going to have a huge impact on traffic in this town when it eventually gets done. But if you're down near, I call it the Iowa DOT's parking lot down there on South Grand, you can see work happening. it's moving forward as we speak. Now, there's a lot of work to be done before we're going to be driving on that road. But it is moving forward. So that's going to be a big deal. South Fifth, which is the extension over towards Aldi's in that area, that's going to be part of that project too. So all that is happening. That continues to move forward too. So again, it's hopefully a sense of normalcy. You know, there are two seasons in Ames. It's either snowing or construction, and we're coming into construction right now.
Okay. Well, thank you for being so unstoppable. We're speaking with Justin Claussen, Operations Manager for City of Ames Public Works. And thank you, Susan, for joining us again today. And we'll see you again soon, right? Tomorrow, I think. Okay. Anna Banana has appeared. Hi, Anna.
Yeah. Hi, Anna Banana in the house. And so I'm going to start today because as I prepared and read through the messages, which are tied together with this lovely sentiment of gratitude and kindness, and we could all use a bit of encouragement during these COVID-19 days, especially in these moments when we feel distressed. And so for the person who kept his distance but still helped me pick up the groceries after I did an evil Knievel move with my grocery cart, thank you. Thank you for not laughing at me for being so stupid, thinking I could clear that concrete curb. And I thank you also for not judging me for the two boxes of Sara Lee cheesecake that spilled out of the bag onto the ground. So if you're listening out there, I just want you to know both those boxes of cheesecake were not mine. I also want to say to my mom, who has been grieving the loss of her husband during this time of social isolation, got into a fender bender yesterday when she was picking up her groceries. And my mom started crying when she saw the damage to her little car. And to the man in that Ford 150, Anna Banana thanks you for kindness and taking care of my mom in this moment. COVID-19 might cause undue stress and anxiety, but I'm glad this hasn't stopped these lovely acts of kindness. So that is my shout out. And Sean, who's a blessing, superstar contributor for Heart to Heart Messages, has a series of shout out messages for us today. So Sean says, a shout out to all those volunteers at Food at First who provide a valuable resource for the community, feeding hungry families through their marketplace and providing meals 7 days a week. And she wanted you to know they serve dinner Sunday through Friday from 5:45 to 6:15. And the free market is Monday and Thursday, 4:45 through 5:30. Saturday, 10 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. Oh, I'm sorry. That's not right. Don't go there at 10:30 p.m. 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at 611 Clark and Ames. And Sean wanted everyone to know that the need is bigger than ever. So if you can volunteer or help them, give Food at First a call. She says, a shout out to all the frontline staff at all the supermarkets in the area. Wheatsfield, Hy-Vee, Fairway, Walmart, Target, Treats on a Leash, Brekkies, Petco, and all others, helping those keep our families and animals fed. A huge shout out to those doing the shopping for those of us who are elderly or high risk to help us avoid contact with others. A shout out to all the ways of finding creativity to interact with each other from a distance from eggs. I think she means eggs delivery. Bears. I don't know what she means by bears. Paintings in windows, chalk on the sidewalks, car parades, dropping treats to each other's homes, using technology to share holidays with our family and friends while we can't be together. Sean, if you're listening, I would like to know what we're keeping a distance from bears. So please help me out with that one. Are there bears in Story County? I have no idea. Shout out to all the zoos. Oh, maybe there's a zoo where the bears are getting out. We're social distancing from the bears. I'm getting distracted here.
I think they're talking about the bears that put on the windows. The people go around town and look for bears on windows for children.
Oh, thank you, Ursula. I was imagining these huge bears over social distancing to keep creative. I'm like, what is going on in Story County? So thanks for that clarification. So then she also says, a shout out to all the trainers and teachers from our gyms coming up with creative ways to keep us moving while we're all stuck at home. Now, speaking of being stuck at home, my cheesecake Sara Lee incident, which again, both of those were not mine. I do know that my fitness routines have suffered terribly, and Anna Banana should be eating more bananas and fewer bags of Fritos and bean dip. And this self-imposed nutritional deprivation has led to the dependency on wearing baggy sweatpants and, in real life, no kidding, fear of putting on a pair of spandex shorts. As the kids say, hashtag the struggle is real. But I'm also going to listen to local talk and the advice to today's guidance to go slow approach. So whether it's laziness or just making sure that I keep everybody healthy, I am going to stay away from the gyms, even if they are open. But the fact is, I really can't let COVID-19 turn me into an inactive blob that sits on her sofa caught in a Netflix black hole. And I can't blame a global pandemic for my sloth-like behavior either. It isn't COVID-19 that is feeding me an endless supplies of cheese puffs and Skittles. Yes, I need to return to the activities that I once enjoyed, like running and yoga. Now, the thing I love about yoga is that it's a place to feel safe. You don't feel judged or condemned for what your body is and the limitations I mentioned as I need to, be forgiving of this COVID-19 body that's happening. Past yoga classes I've attended, the instructors preach that it's not a competition, that you have to be listening to your body and be kind. And so this next heart-to-heart message is from Michelle Flattery, a yoga instructor with Ignite Yoga and Ames Fitness, who's been doing these online yoga sessions, which, again, no excuse. I need to do them instead of just watching them. And so she gives us this heart-to-heart message, which I love about yoga with this message. Michelle writes, "Today I woke up with a heart wanting to shine. I looked out my window and gave God thanks for this beautiful day. I am grateful that my family is able to be home safe together due to my health. I will show my gratitude by feeding my body with health and mind. I will show my gratitude by seeing and hearing my children while surrounding me. I will show my gratitude by keeping my living space inviting for my family during the day. Today, shine that glowing light that surrounds me, your heart, every day a little brighter. Not only will you feel the shine within you, it will radiate to others surrounding you. So much love and light to you all on this shining day." Oh, what a beautiful message. That does inspire me to get moving. Our last heart-to-heart message today comes from Becky Orr Montgomery, owner and founder of Senior Home Finder of Iowa, who shares this poem with you. "When doubts and fears are growing, it's hard to keep on going. From day to day, not knowing just what the end will be. Take each day as you find it. If things go wrong, don't mind it, for each day leaves behind it a chance to start anew. Chin up," from Becky. Love this, as I'm going to keep my chin up today, or my many chins, thanks to donuts and ding-dongs. So thank you, Becky, Michelle, and Sean, for your heart-to-heart messages. I hope that each of you found as inspiring, encouraging, and hopeful as I did. So if you would like to respond to these heart-to-heart messages, call or text Anna Banana at 515-809-0077.
Thank you. Give that number one more time, Anna.
Sure. 515-809-0077.
Okay. Thank you, Anna Banana Brad, and we will see you again next time. And you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community COVID Response Coronavirus Pivotal Radio here in Central Iowa. And we've been your hosts, Ann Kinzel and Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening.
Yes, Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember, you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org. You can also support KHOI there, and you can find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember that KHOI is streaming live on khoifm.org.
Our theme song. Sorry.
Stereo, folks. Go ahead, Ursula.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. Two notes to make. Actually, today at noon and 7 p.m., stay tuned for KHOI Previews the Arts with Carol Horowitz. And tune in on Fridays. Be sure to tune in to Ames Police Officer Kruger reading children's books on KHOI and at noon. And if you have a young child, they won't want to miss it. And by the way, if there's any bit of child in you, no matter what age you are, you don't want to miss it. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. now, and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. If you are a member, please renew your membership. This would be a great time to do it because help us get through the COVID crisis. And if you're not, please consider becoming a member by going to khoifm.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.